Welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar,
the podcast where we mix a sometimes weird but always delicious cocktail of theology, philosophy, and spirituality.
Well, welcome, friends, to another episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar. I'm excited about today's episode. I'm always excited about our episodes, but today's a fun one. We have a fun guest. His name is Brian Zond, which hopefully many of you recognize and know and love already, and perhaps hopefully also some of you don't, and I think you're in for a real treat. If you don't know who Brian Zond is, today is going to be a treat. You're welcome in advance.
Yeah, this is a good one. I'm excited about this episode.
Yeah, we talk about everything from the Book of Revelation to Bob Dylan, so get ready.
Yeah, he's one of those guys you could just talk to for hours, I feel like, if you wanted to.
I absolutely could have.
Easy. I think part of it is that he's Southern. Maybe I'm biased, but I just find it easier to talk to Southern people. They're just like no assumptions, no whatever, chill, laid back.
Yeah, I feel like Southern people take enough flack from us Northerners, us elitists. Let's give them a little credit. They're better to talk to.
Absolutely. I don't think I shared with you guys either. Brian's been in my Twitter feed for a long time, just one of those people that I've followed over the years, and I've really appreciated his presence through what's been my kind of deconstruction or just journey away from my more evangelical roots, but still trying to hold on to the scripture and hold on to Jesus and understand how this all shapes out. He's been one of those voices there's something about him that still holds closely to the church and loves these things that are so central to my faith. But he's also willing to step outside of those things. I've just appreciated that consistently over the years that I've been just watching him and being ministered to him from a distance. So it's really fun to get to see him on the other side of the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a prophetic voice. It's a good time. But first, let's do a tasting. I'm excited about what we're going to taste today. This is from our friends at Story Hill BKC. If you're in Milwaukee, you better know the name Story Hill BKC, and I got to tell you, this product that we're going to sample today, I'm pretty sure it's something that you're going to want to run out and get because it is limited and it is really fun. Today we're drinking Buffalo Trace, which already, that's enough right there, saying you're drinking Buffalo Trace. It's hard to find, remarkably. When I first started getting into bourbon, names like Eagle Rare and Buffalo Trace were everywhere, and they are not anymore. I don't know why. Maybe you know, Kyle.
The reason is simple. It's because the Pappy Van Winkle craze took off, and then people started looking for everything else that Buffalo Trace makes. And so, you know, the higher expressions became harder to get, and then suddenly the not-so-shouldn't be hard-to-find stuff like Eagle Rare suddenly becomes allocated, and you can't even find that at your average liquor store anymore. Mm-hmm. And now Buffalo Trace itself, which is like the entry-level expression for the distillery, one of the best deals in whiskey at usually about $20 a bottle, and now you can't find it sitting on a shelf anywhere.
Yep.
But it is. Buffalo Trace is in Milwaukee, right? It's at Story Hills.
Yep. We know where you can get some. And not just any. This is a special bottling. Why don't you tell us about that, Randy?
Yeah. So our friends at Story Hill BKC have a relationship with the Buffalo Trace Distillery, and they were invited out to come and take their pick of a barrel. So most Buffalo Trace that you drink, if not all Buffalo Trace that you drink, is a blend of a number of different barrels that the master distiller puts together, thinks is the best, and that's how you get it. This right here that we're drinking tonight is a single barrel select release. So our friends from the Story Hill BKC went, sampled 7 different barrels, and said, this is the one we want. And then they came home with 250-ish bottles, and they only have about 30 left. That was about a week ago when I heard it. So there's about 24 of these bottles left. Go get one now. Well, let's taste it and find out if we can say go get one now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like this has a much stronger barrel presence than the typical. I know that's like a really vague thing to say, but the oak, the vanilla comes through much stronger for me. It feels like a higher proof, even though I don't think it is.
Yeah, this is 45%. For me, it's kind of like, this is a journey. Like, it starts sweet. Right away it's sweet, and then it goes savory, cinnamon, and nutmeg. But then the lasting flavor is more citrus and like the zesty, yummy. I mean, it's
this is
all good.
Yeah, first of all, I'll say indeed, go get it right now from Storyhill BKC if you're in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
If you're around Milwaukee, make the drive. But for me, it's cinnamon is major here in this mm-hmm. bottle. The barrel presence, like you said, Kyle. But for me, the after flavor that I was just like loving indefinitely was vanilla.
Yeah.
Lots of vanilla on the back of the palate.
And it lingers. It has a much longer finish than the typical Buffalo Trace I've had.
This is way better than any Buffalo Trace I've had. And here's what our friends at Storyhill BKC recommended as well, is try to grab a regular bottle of Buffalo Trace and then grab this as well and just have a fun night doing your own tasting, comparing them.
Yeah, that would be fun. Let's do that.
This is delicious. This is, I would say this is definitely the best Buffalo Trace I've ever had.
Really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So rush down there and get you a bottle before they're gone.
Yeah. Tell them that we sent you. Just say that you heard about it on a pastor philosopher walk into a bar.
Do that. And if you're not in Milwaukee, find a local place to support and support their pants off. Cheers.
Cheers.
There's where our Wisconsin comes through. Cheers.
Cheers. Oh, yeah.
Well, Brian Zond, thank you so much for taking time and talking with us. Welcome to A Pastor and Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
Oh, good to be with you. I like the name of the podcast.
Yeah?
That's a good one.
My wife named it, so I'll tell you said that.
All right.
There you go. There you go.
We do have, as part of our theme, we're a pastor and a philosopher walk into a bar. So if there's anything you have next to you that you're drinking that you want to mention, that
you
would
know,
be welcome.
I'll wait till I'm done. I feel like maybe some Ardbeg,
ooh,
Corey of Reckon tonight, but
yes,
we'll wait till I'm done.
My wife and I actually honeymooned in Scotland a few years ago and spent most of our time on the Isla.
Yeah, I've been there. I've been to all those distilleries, and Perry and I, that's my wife, we're planning on going back next year, assuming we can do such things, and walk the St. Cuthbert's Way and then hang out on Isla.
It's a place to be.
And Perry wants to go to she likes the spiritual island, and I like the spirit island. what's the other one? The little tiny one that's known for its little tiny monastery. So we have the spiritual island and the spirit island.
Nice. Both important.
Right.
Brian, for our listeners who might not be familiar with who you are, what you do, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a pastor, and I encountered Jesus when I was 16 years old. That was a long time ago. I'm 61 now, so you just invert those numbers. And overnight, I went from being the high school Zeppelin freak to the high school Jesus freak. It was no small news. And by the time I was 17, I was leading a ministry this is during the Jesus movement. We called it a coffee house. It was mostly a music venue for the Jesus music scene of those days. That essentially I was leading and pastoring and, you know, leading kids to Jesus. That turned into our church in November of 1981, so 39 years ago. So I tell people, I've been a pastor longer than I've been an adult.
Wow.
And so, I mean, officially, I became a pastor when I was 22. But essentially, I've been doing it since I was 17. So now, you know, there's been all kinds of twists and turns and all of that over those 39 or 45 years, depending on how you think of it. But, you know, when all's said and done, yeah, I write books. I used to travel before COVID. I speak a lot. I do all of that sort of stuff. But as far as vocationally, I'm a pastor. That's really what I am.
Love it.
Of one church for almost now 40 years.
Yeah, that's incredible. First question about what you just said. You said you went from a Zeppelin freak to a Jesus freak. You didn't lose the Zeppelin when you met Jesus, though, did you?
No. Oh,
good.
Oh, no. I just... No.
Yes. Good.
You know, if you know anything about me, you know I'm a music neurotic.
I know you are.
I love music, and Zeppelin still maintains a lofty perch in my pantheon.
Yes.
I'm ashamed to say I did have the phase where I threw out all my Zeppelin albums and then regretted it later.
Yeah. Dang it.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, so, I did too, but it didn't last long, and it was always half-hearted.
I just kept that the reality that I listened to Zeppelin for my parents. They never knew. So, So, Brian, the fact that you have pastored the same church for about 40 years is remarkable, and particularly because I know your story a bit, that you went through a major faith deconstruction, reconstruction. You went through the whole ringer while in ministry, while leading that church. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What kind of brand of Christian were you before that? And then what was the trigger? Just tell us about that process.
Well, as I said, I started off in the Jesus movement. Not that I made a choice. It's just what happened. And that led us into the charismatic movement, which I describe as good until it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that kind of led into various forms of word of faith and all of that sort of stuff. Never really making a decision. It's just kind of what happened. And as I entered my 40s, I began to have a deep sense of discontent. And I thought, well, how did I get here? I started off as a radical Jesus freak, and what am I going to end up just as a Republican with a Jesus fish on his SUV?
Sounds about right.
It's like I'd got on the wrong bus somewhere. And I thought, how did I get here?
And did Word of Life grow and get big by that point?
Oh, yeah. It started off small and then got a little bit bigger and then got ridiculously huge and in the 90s. And that was exhilarating. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was fun to have that kind of growth. But as we came to the end of the 90s and going into 2000 and beyond, I was just discontent. I didn't ever really have a crisis of faith regarding Jesus. I just felt like the Jesus that I loved deserved a better Christianity than I knew. Mm. And I didn't know where to find it. So what I did was I thought, well, I'm just going to back up. And I started reading church fathers, which, you know, we were not necessarily encouraged to do in the charismatic movement.
Absolutely.
And so I started reading church fathers and philosophy, because I'd always kind of liked philosophy. Again, that was sort of dismissed, but I thought, well, okay, I read it on the sly, you know, when people weren't looking. And so I was reading patristics and philosophy, and maybe just, I would call it the canon of Western literature. And I did that for about 4 years without it necessarily erupting in who I was and in my preaching. But by the time I reached 2004, that all changed. And I remember announcing to my church in 2004 that I was packing my bags and moving on from the charismatic movement. Now, packing my bags meant that I was going to take, you know, that which was valuable, I would keep. And I did it with enough rhetorical skill that they all applauded when I announced this until I actually did it.
Yeah.
And then we went through a period where we lost over 1,000 people. And these are people that I had maybe, these are people we knew and loved.
Yeah.
That maybe I'd led to the Lord, baptized, married, baptized their children, married their children. Mm-hmm. And they were leaving and saying mean things like they thought I was backslidden. And I thought, I think I've front slidden. I've never been more passionate about Jesus than I am right now. But so many people couldn't understand that. So that was what was it like? Well, I think it's an interesting story. I mean, I tell it in it's kind of a memoir-ish, Water to Wine. It was heaven and hell simultaneously. It was heaven in that, and I'll say we, because my wife was with me every step of the way. There was never any disagreement on that. And I just felt like what I was discovering in a rich, robust theological tradition was what I'd been really looking for all of my life. And so that was heaven. But to lose friends and all of that and the pressure that comes from that, it was a very painful and difficult time. Now, I want people to know that we're through that time and we're happy and healthy and the church is good, so you don't have to like feel sorry for me. it's good. But it was hell going through it. And it was I don't like you saying this because I think it alarms maybe pastors, but it was 10 years to go through. Ooh. It was 10 years that was hard. Mm-hmm. And from, let's say, 2004 to 2014. And I think part of what makes it interesting is I did it relatively publicly. Hmm. And I think that's why maybe people find it interesting that I was able to more or less take the church with me. Now, you know, minus 1,000 people, which yep. was like half. But, you know, mm-hmm. we were able to do it.
I can't imagine the spiritual maturity that gets cultivated when a group of people who, you know, hopefully that 1,000 that you were left with really saw each other's spiritual family then.
Yeah,
when they go through a collective evolution of their theology together, like how incredibly discipling is a 10-year journey of discovery in a deeper dive into the rich heart of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit? I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think you just did. I mean, it was like that because we have the other side of the story too, that today, over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, we've had people, and this doesn't happen very often, but we've had it happen fairly regularly, that people have moved to little old St. Joseph, Missouri, town of 70,000 in Northwest Missouri, to be a part of our church, and not a few pastors who tried to go on some kind of, well, I call it the water to wine journey, and ended up losing their pastoral vocation and have found Word of Life Church as a place of healing, kind of mm-hmm. a shelter from the storm. And it's been rewarding, no doubt. But I have to be honest, it didn't come without pain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
as Bob Dylan says in one of his songs, behind every beautiful thing, there's been some kind of pain. And that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Would you still describe yourself as charismatic or Pentecostal, or where did you guys land?
It depends on who's asking. If someone is asking in a way expecting me to say no, I'll say yes. Because I don't use that very often as a term of self-designation. I'm not trying to be evasive. We don't really have a good term for what we are. I mean, you know, on Sunday mornings, you're going to have the kind of the rock and roll worship with drums and guitars and all of that, because I belong to the generation that fought the battle to get them in church. So I'm keeping them.
Thank you, by the way.
But we're also liturgical and sacramental. So we're kind of doing a lot of things at the same time. So I don't know, maybe we're rock and roll liturgical. I don't have a handy term, but as far as, I mean, it's not an emphasis, but I still think of myself as charismatic in some ways. Although when I look around at my compatriots turning into Trumpers, you know, I don't get that at all. But the idea of having a vibrant, real experience of the Holy Spirit is, it's extremely New Testament for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something to aspire to and hold on to.
Yeah. You still believe in the gifts of the Spirit, would you say?
Yeah, I do, but not in a kind of sensationalist, not a cessationist or sensationalist way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's something to, at this point in time, I don't feel the need to make it our thing, but I actually believe that, you know, that mystical experiences in the Spirit are normative to the Christian life,
mm-hmm.
and should be thought of that way.
Yeah. It's ironic because I was just listening to, you referenced on Twitter, I think last week, a message that you preached 5 years ago, I think almost to the day, that was a prophetic word for the church. That's the way you framed it.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. And I was looking at some old notes and came across that. And then after I tweeted that, somebody had, it might have been someone at our church.
It was somebody at our church, actually.
Oh, was that you?
Yeah, that wasn't me, but it was somebody from our church, yeah.
Yeah, that I don't know who produced it. Maybe Word of Life, I don't know. And I sat there and I listened to that, and I thought, I think that was prophetic.
I think so,
too. What are you going to say? But in a sad sort of way, because mm-hmm. we failed the test. I mean, we, in general, I don't think all of us did, but...
Well, first of all, I'll recommend to any listeners to go back and listen to that. But could you give just a little microcosm of that prophetic word that you gave 5 years ago?
I don't know if I can. I mean, I had the sense that we were entering into a time of testing, whether we would follow the way of hate or the way of love. And to this, I just came upon it and I sort of tweeted that because I was looking at what I'd said, but I don't remember it that well. But it seems to me that much of the charismatic and certainly the evangelical church in America has failed that test and rallied around a message of who we're going to hate. And of course, scapegoating and hating the other is a very effective way of drawing people together. The only problem is that it's demonic. So
just that little thing.
I don't have notes with me about that.
I've got the
like that,
but, the tweet here. It's 5 years ago. You're looking at your sermon notes and the things that you were saying at that time. You were saying that this is a dangerous time. It's going to be a time of temptation. The church will be tested about how serious we are about following Jesus, and Satan will tempt us to react in fear and hatred, bigotry, and scapegoating.
That came
right there.
When I tweeted it, I just took that verbatim from my sermon notes. Yeah. And then the clip of me, the audio clip of me saying it, you can tell I'm obviously not just reading notes, I'm riffing on it. And
sounds pretty accurate to me.
I think as far as I can be objective about something I said 5 years ago, it seems like, yeah, I would say that was relatively prophetic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wanting to know, for the sake of my co-host here, Brian, as you dove into the patristics and all that, but you also said you did a lot of philosophy reading. What are some of your favorite philosophers, or what's some of your favorite work that you discovered?
Well, I don't know about favorite. But the two philosophers, I mean, Derrida, and I did a fairly deep dive into, and just, you know, of course, you got to have your Plato and Aristotle. But the two that I would feel comfortable around a PhD philosopher talking about would be Kierkegaard and Nietzsche.
Nice.
And I think I'm really well read in both of them. In a forthcoming book, I finished the manuscript, but it'll come out sometime next year. I talk about the fantasy I have of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard meeting one another, sitting down to have lunch together, because in some ways they're saying something very similar. They didn't know of each other. Apparently Nietzsche had perhaps heard of Kierkegaard, but had not read anything by him. You know, Kierkegaard's a few years older and he'd already died. But, I mean, Kierkegaard was hardly known outside of Copenhagen at that time anyway. I think that would have been fascinating. And I think it's a bit sad because I can just imagine Kierkegaard listening to Nietzsche and saying, yes, 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 but. and Kierkegaard could bring as a strident critique of 19th century Christendom as Nietzsche, but still found a way to hold on to faith. And I like reading Nietzsche. I agree with him 75% of the time. Now, the 25% I disagree is like way important. Here's the thing with Nietzsche. He's one of the, as has been described, one of the masters of suspicion, along with Freud and Marx. And I won't talk much about Freud and Marx, but what Nietzsche is suspicious of is the reality of real love, of true love, of Christian love, of co-suffering love, of altruistic love. He wants to dismiss it as slave morality, a way that the weak manipulate the strong. He simply didn't believe that it could exist. Hmm. And, you wonder sometimes, I mean, you can't separate philosophers from who they are as human beings. And I'm not trying to be cute here, but I do seriously wonder how much of Nietzsche's philosophy was at least influenced by the fact that he proposed twice and was turned down twice. And
he said the same thing for Kierkegaard.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah, he just needed somebody to take.
I think they'd both just have a pity party over their failed romantic lives.
True. I just say that somebody needed Kierkegaard needed someone to take him to the Dairy Queen.
Apparently, he did have like close friends, though, including at least one clergyman who he maintained a lifelong friendship with. But
yeah, those are the two that I feel confident that I can say I'm well read in, and to what extent they influence me. You go through a phase I think in 2006, I was reading too much Kierkegaard, and it was slipping into my preaching too much. And I look back and say, yeah, that probably wasn't my best stuff. But I think in some ways, those that get serious about Christian thought have to go through a Kierkegaard phase. I mean, that's what Barth said. You have to go through it, but then you have to keep going.
Some people get stuck there.
Right.
I might be one of those people. I feel like if you ever take Nietzsche seriously in particular, he never leaves your head. I feel like he's been embedded in my brain since I was younger.
And see, Rene Girard's the same way. Once you get that little Girardian thing in you, it's there. You're infected.
Yeah.
So, Brian, I love your work on the Book of Revelation. I love your thoughts on it. You did a really, really wonderful sermon series on it and have kind of turned into an expert on Revelation in many ways.
I wouldn't go that far, but okay.
Okay, all right. I hope you write a book about it.
I have written an introduction in a study Bible to Revelation. I was asked to do Jonah, Matthew, Titus, and Revelation, to which I said, I don't know anything about Titus, but I'll read it a few times and see what I can come up with. But yeah. I was really glad to do Revelation.
Yeah, I've got two books I want you to write. They're the Randy and I request list for Brian's on. One is a book on Revelation, and because we need it. And two is a book that we'll talk about later that I really want you to write, which is The Theology of Bob Dylan. But we'll get to that later. So can you give our...
It could happen.
For our listeners who aren't as familiar with a revelation that actually speaks to us in our present moment and also spoke to and was relevant for its original hearers and listeners and readers, can you just give us a revelation for dummies in about 3 minutes or less?
Okay, we'll see. Revelation is, the book of Revelation is basically four things. First of all, it's a prophetic, and this might be the most difficult to understand, but it's a prophetic interpretation of the tumultuous events of the 60s and 70s. I don't mean the 1960s and 70s. I mean the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. I think the book uses a literary device that you'll find in the book of Daniel, where it is positioning itself as if it's predicting future events, when actually what it's doing is looking back probably about 20 to 30 years, 20 years closer, 20, 25 years, and giving a prophetic interpretation of what they've just been through. The most significant event during that time would have been the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and the deportation of a whole lot of slaves to Rome, who were then employed in the construction of the Colosseum. And it was money from the Jewish treasury that largely funded the construction of the Colosseum. It was just a very difficult time, a crop failure in Egypt, which was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire that created problems. There was some plagues and all sorts of things. And I think it's a very creative interpretation of those events. Secondly, and maybe this is the most important one, the most prevalent one, it's a prophetic critique of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And so this is the beast. I mean, the beast is the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. 666 is Nero. Probably this is written during the reign of Domitian. This is like in the 90s, but it's looking back on the very strange and odd reign of Nero, who, at least according to church tradition, put to death both Peter and Paul. And but it's simply because I think by the time we get to the 90s, things are calming down. And it's easy for Christians in the Roman Empire to view the empire as relatively benign and sort of be drawn into, be lulled to sleep anyway. And I think John the Revelator is just pounding the table saying, no, remember, this thing is a beast. Mm-hmm. And that at its heart, it is evil and destructive. The third thing I would say, and this is maybe related, and this is an application for us today, it's a prophetic expose of empire and civil religion, mm-hmm. About how the worship of the empire itself allegiance to the empire itself can take on religious overtones. And then very often what happens is in some way the empire needs to be personified. And this is how you saw the rise of the emperor cult, which began in the eastern provinces to whom this letter is addressed, not in Rome, because Rome's too close to the emperor. They're never going to, people that actually live in Rome aren't going to believe this guy's a god. But the people out in the provinces are being drawn into the cult of emperor worship, which is really a way of personifying the empire into a single person. And the book of Revelation is a very powerful expose of that. And then finally, it's just a, how would I say it? It's a prophetic portrayal of the ultimate triumph of Christ. That's the one aspect that I would say is future. Mm-hmm. Okay, if there's one thing that's future, it's just the holy imagination of St. John the Revelator as he portrays very creatively, artistically, the ultimate triumph of Christ, which when he's composing this, I think is amazing that he did foresee that ultimately this thing is going to triumph. I'm over my 3 minutes, I'm quite sure. But But I want to throw in one more thing. I see the book of Revelation as carrying aspects of a Greco-Roman play, complete with drama, tragedy, comedy, and chorus. And you can see that, for example, in chapter 5, when John is being kind of hosted by the elder, and we're shown that in the right hand of the one who sits upon a throne, there is a scroll that seems to have something to do with God's intentions and purposes for humanity, for history itself, but it's sealed with seven seals. And before God's purposes, let's say redemptive purposes, can be unleashed, someone has to be found worthy to break the seals and proclaim the goodness of the scroll. And that's the drama. Mm-hmm. And then there's none found worthy. Mm-hmm. And John begins to weep greatly. Mm-hmm. That's the tragedy. Because, I mean, what would be more tragic than to think that the way the world has been is the way it has to be forever? Mm-hmm. Okay, but then the elder says, "Whoa, hold on, don't weep, don't weep. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah has overcome. Mm-hmm. And is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll." And so it's, look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and John looks, and what does he see? Does he see a lion? He does not see a lion. He sees a lamb, a little lamb, a little lamb, a baby lamb, as if slain, but standing again. So let's say we're in the African Serengeti and we know there might be lions about, and we're walking along and I say, "Look, a lion." And you look and it's the lamb, you know. You laugh, ha ha, it's a joke. Well, that is the comedic part of the book of Revelation. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, but the lion is the lamb. People say, you know, Jesus came as a lamb, he's coming back as a lion, book of Revelation. Nonsense. There's no lion in the book of Revelation. There's only a lamb. Mm-hmm. And one of the comedic, and of course, then what happens, the very next thing that happens is the chorus breaks out. And there's all of this anthem of praise that worthy is the lamb. And so one of the things I love about the book of Revelation is you have this comedy of these beasts with their seven heads and 10 horns that appear so fearsome, you know, some sort of, you know, like first century Godzillas, are being defeated by this tiny little lamb that has been slain, but is still standing on its feet. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was probably like 7 or 8 minutes, but anyway, it's the best.
Standing ovation. Sorry. Good. Amazing job.
So I have a quick follow-up if that's okay. So for our listeners who hear prophecy and think future, like, three out of the four things you said included the word prophecy, but the first thing said it was about something that happened 20 years ago. So can you just quickly explain how something could be prophetic if it's not actually about the future?
Yeah, prophetic as in apocalyptic, as in, you know, apocalypse, as in revelation. That is revealing, it is showing what has been perhaps obscured by propaganda, by lies, by deceit. And in its best form, prophecy is the truth of God that shines through all the dissimulation that is so present in our corrupted world. So maybe prophecy is a spirit-empowered truth-telling We might think of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Not primarily prognostication.
Sure.
Yeah. If I did a sermon series on Revelation as well, and when people ask me about Revelation or when I talk about Revelation, I would say it's primarily a book about allegiance. And that's not me. That's Michael Gorman and many others, right? But
right.
Revelation is a book that's about allegiance. Can you flesh that out a little bit, particularly, Brian, in context of what we are living in right now as Christians in America?
Look, I don't think there's any book of the Bible that is more relevant to a certain strand of American Christians right now than the book of Revelation, but you're going to have to learn how to read it right.
Yes.
I mean, if you see it as a, you know, foretelling of, you know, global political events 2,000 years from the time that it was written, then you're going to be off track.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can see it as a true prophet contending at a particular place in time, that those who are baptized maintain unrivaled allegiance to Jesus Christ as Lord and not be seduced into compromising with the beast or with some form of the cult of emperor worship so that you end up with a 666 on your right hand or on your head. If we can see that Jesus is Lord, the seminal Christian confession, was originally heard in its original context primarily as a political statement, not a religious statement,
mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden the book of Revelation has new currency. What happened was, with the rise of a so-called Christian emperor, centuries later, around the year 312, with Constantine, we're back to thinking, well, okay, Caesar's kind of Lord too, so Jesus must have some other role. Let's see. Oh, what happens is Jesus gets demoted from truly being Lord to the Secretary of Afterlife Affairs.
There you go.
And his job is really to get us into heaven when we die. In the meantime, we'll let Caesar run the world. And then we get all caught up in, you know, is it our Caesar? And I am political in the sense that politics is simply, you know, the discussion and the attempt at human flourishing in a cooperative way. Collective way, and I think Christ speaks to all of that. What I am not is partisan. I'm radically, deeply, sincerely, this is not, you know, rhetoric. I'm committed to the Lamb. Mm-hmm. I don't follow a donkey, don't follow an elephant. I follow the Lamb. I have no allegiance to partisanship. I have no particular allegiance to the United States, other than I think I comport myself as a good citizen. I'm happy to, you know, pay my fair share of taxes. I wish that more of it would go to just human flourishing and less of it would go to waging war, but I can't control all of that. But I regard my citizenship as a philosophical accidental. It's not ontologically part of who I am. Yeah, I have a passport back when I used to travel. You know, it's blue. It's got a seal of the United States on it. Says I'm an American. Okay, fine. You know, I hold that loosely. I need it, but I hold it loosely because upon my baptism, I became the citizen of another kingdom. And all of my allegiance is pledged to Christ. And I just don't have any other allegiance left over. I will be a responsible citizen that I think will contribute to the well-being of my community. But I won't stand and put my, you know, this liturgical gesture mm-hmm. and pledge allegiance to the United States. I don't stand and sing the national anthem. Sometimes if I'm at a football game, I will stand. I don't sing it. Why do you stand? I just don't want to get beat up. You know, call me a sissy, but I just don't want to.
Yep. Yeah, you're in good company.
Usually what I do is when it's about time for the national anthem, I feel led to go get a hot dog or go to the men's room or something like that. So I'm just out of the stadium.
Perfect. Yep. I don't know how things are in St. Joseph, Missouri. I'm assuming they're pretty similar to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I would say that I've been a pastor for about 15 years, so mm-hmm. not even half as long as you have, but long enough to say that I think I've seen and witnessed before my eyes the biggest corrupting influence in the church. That is politics, where I've watched people who are well-intentioned and wonderful people, really, basically conflate their politics and political ideology with their theology. And they've actually given over kingdom issues to politics. And they let whichever side they see themselves on, that's how they engage and think that God thinks about this or the scriptures think about it. And they, I could go on and on. I'm assuming you see that in St. Joseph's that and have seen that happening around the church in America as well.
Of course. And this is something that I've been talking about and writing about for, well, probably 16 years now. And I think I'm situated as well as anyone to understand what has happened, or at least to be a witness to it. And I'm still astounded.
Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely astounded the degree to which so many Christian leaders in America have, in my estimation, sold their soul for proximity to power.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes to prove to you how intoxicating power can be. It is the one ring to rule them all.
Wow.
I mean, so if you think about Lord of the Rings, it's the ring of power. And no one can seem to bear that ring without being corrupted by it. Even a, you know, even such a humble little hobbit as Frodo in the final moment mm-hmm. can't let go of it, mm-hmm. and fate has to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think if we're going to follow Jesus and be witnesses for this other kingdom that is the kingdom of Christ, we have to know ourselves well enough to say, I can't get very close to that ring of power, or I will be enchanted by it. I'll be intoxicated by it. The eye of Sauron will fall upon me, and who knows what I'll do. And so that's why for years, I mean, I've never accepted an invitation to Washington, prayer breakfast, other things I've been invited. I've just always said no I think I've just had enough grace to know I will not trust myself to get that close to that much power and not have it mesmerize me.
Hmm. So would you say then that it might be a bad idea for Christians to go into the political world, or would you disagree with that?
I don't think there's a one-time answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, what do we mean by the political world? Can a Christian be the county assessor? Yeah, I would think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's level. I mean, we can vote, we can run for office, we can hold office as long as it doesn't compromise our allegiance to Jesus Christ. But I think we have to enter that process with our eyes wide open.
Mm-hmm.
That the higher we move in the ranks of power, the more difficult it is going to be for us to maintain complete fidelity to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a healthier democracy, at a different time, I probably wouldn't be too concerned about Christians entering the political process as far as office holders. Currently, it seems so toxic, so partisan-driven, that I would want to at least raise a cautionary flag.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't. I'm not going to make a clear. I'm not a Christian anarchist, mm-hmm. I don't want to present a situation where no Christian can participate in public life. I don't think I want, you know, the United States to be the place where no Christian's a school teacher or serves in, you know, city government or anything. That's not where I'm coming from. But I think we just have to recognize that once you get mesmerized by power, there's never enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you will incrementally, inch by inch, travel, who knows? It seems like 1,000 miles in betrayal of your fidelity to Christ to maintain some sort of nearness to power.
Mm-hmm.
So we recently did an episode on patriotism, nationalism, that sort of thing. And we had a small disagreement between us about whether there is such a thing as the virtue of patriotism. I come down on the side of thinking there's probably no such thing. And Randy came down on the side of thinking that there is a healthy kind of patriotism. I wonder where you stand on that.
If by patriotism we simply mean pride of place that sort of impels us towards responsible citizenship and neighborliness, I think that's good. You know, if I'm in Portugal, which is a country I've traveled to and in a lot, if I'm in Portugal and see in a church a Portuguese flag, I don't particularly like it, but I'm not particularly alarmed by it either. Because, you know, Portugal hasn't been an empire for, you know, what, 400 years or something. And but when I see an American flag in a church or a Russian flag, when I'm in Russia, those make me very nervous. Because here's where I make the distinction. I mean, we're talking about patriotism, nationalism. How about a distinction between just a nation and an empire? Empire, because I need to define terms. I mean something quite specific. Empires are not just nations. God seems to love nations with their ethnicity, culture, language, diversity, all of that. It doesn't seem to me that God wants the globe, the world, to be one giant American mall. You know, the idea that it would be diverse in language, culture, ethnicity, all of that seems healthy and good. I celebrate it. But that's not empires. Empires are rich, powerful nations who believe they have a divine right to rule other nations and a manifest destiny to shape history according to their agenda. When a nation aspires to that kind of status, they begin to impinge upon the sovereignty of God, who's made that very promise to his beloved son. So who has a divine right to rule nations and a manifest destiny to shape history? It's Jesus Christ, not the United States of America or any other nation that seeks to become an empire.
Come on.
So, you know, Americans are fond of we're number one, we're number one. Well, there's a lot of pressure there. And you always have to seek to maintain that position. In Portugal, they're like, we're number, what are we? We're like 38, 39, I don't know. And then things are much more calm, relaxed. And so if the Portuguese brethren can sing the Portuguese national anthem with a sense of pride, I say God bless them. But in empires, you better be careful.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
When you were talking about Revelation, it made me think of Nietzsche because he lives in my brain, like I said. So Nietzsche one time apparently quipped, and I only know this because Randy preached a sermon on Revelation where he quoted Nietzsche, and I was like, what? But apparently he accused, or he called it the most vengeful book ever written or something like that. That's a really
bloody vengeful. Saying that.
But like all of the dispensationalists that I grew up learning Christianity from also read it that way. And to find out that it was also Nietzsche's view would shock them, right? So what do you say to someone who sees in it a lot of vengeance? Jesus comes back with a sword and he murders everybody and he fills the valley with blood. And you know somebody who is politically weak is writing this in the midst of empire. Why not read it that way?
Well, first of all, and this may sound simple, but it bears repeating again and again and again. Everything in the book of Revelation is symbol, all of it. I mean, whether we're talking about the beast up out of the sea with seven heads and 10 horns, whether we're talking about the bejeweled city, whether we're talking about a river of blood, whether we're talking about locusts with the face of a man, the hair of a woman, and I forgot all the details of the locust. All of it's symbol. You can't say, well, I'll do it someday. Someday I'm going to go through the book of Revelation and write every single image down. It'll be like writing the whole book of Revelation again. But but there's going to be a little box after each one. Symbol, literal. And then you have to check what you think it is. And then at the very end, it's going to say, explain your system. So people say, okay, is Jesus actually a lamb, literally a lamb, with seven eyes and seven horns? No, I think that's the symbol. But is Jesus going to come back on a flying white horse with a sword in his mouth and kill 200 million people? I think so. Really?
That could be real.
So this is a portrayal of Jesus Christ ultimately overcoming, but he always does it as the lamb. He goes into that battle in Revelation 19 with his robe drenched in blood before the battle, exactly, because he's the one that has shed his blood. And I think of it this way. I'm one of those 200 million. That was, you know, the idea of the population of the world at the time. I am one of those that have been slain by the word that proceeds from the mouth of Christ and then raised to newness of life.
There
again.
We go.
Keep it in the realm of the apocalyptic, of metaphor, of symbol, and maybe just end with the idea that, yeah, okay, there's a lake of fire out there, but what do the Spirit and the bride say from the city? They say, if anyone is thirsty, is anybody thirsty? Well, they're like, we're in a lake of fire. Well, then come into the city. You have 12 gates. You can enter the city from any direction, and the gates are never shut. The gates are there not to keep people out, but to funnel people into the way of the Lamb. I don't find it actually that difficult to not literalize Revelation. And think that at some point in the future, Jesus is going to disavow the Sermon on the Mount and come back and just start killing hundreds of millions of people. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think you just have to understand how creative John the Revelator obviously was. And this is not entirely unique. It's unique. I want to say it's unique to Scripture. It's not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's magnified. It's amplified. But virtually everything in the book of Revelation is borrowed from the Old Testament. I mean, it's all there. He's kind of gathered all of these images and metaphors together and put them in one book, but then amped them up, sort of exaggerated them, because John the Revelator sees that the triumph of Christ is, in fact, enormous, and that, yes, there is now tremendous vengeance falling upon that which has truly brought humanity to suffering, that is, upon the Satan and empire and spiritual wickedness and all of that. And so he's going to depict it in terms of warfare, but I don't think there's a need to literalize it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, when we think of Revelation, we think of judgment. When we go to the angry, spiteful, vengeful kind of judgment, when we think of it, when really judgment in the book of Revelation, that part of the book of Revelation, is all about God setting the world to rights, right?
And
for once and for all, overcoming and cutting the head off of evil and overcoming it by his own blood. And we had Brad Jurczak and William Paul Young on a couple weeks ago, and Brad would say the judgment of God is actually the fiery furnace of the love of God that is dead set on burning anything that is set against love, which is God. He's going to burn that away. And that's the judgment of God, so that we can stand before the God who is love face to face.
I had somebody trying to insult me not long ago because they were alarmed at my theology. And they said, you're going to hell. And I said, probably for a little while. Meaning that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ.
Yes.
We all must pass through the fires of judgment. There's going to be some things that are going to be burned in my life, but I still believe that in the end I'll be saved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's 1 Corinthians. Is it 5? What chapter is that? Any 4? Maybe 4.
Similarly, talking about war now, Brian, you've done extensive work and extensive writing. Farewell to Mars, one of your main books, I would say probably. You speak to your journey out of a militaristic and even kind of, I'll bet you would say, warmongering kind of Christianity, and into a more Christ-like New Testament peace-filled faith. So can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I first encountered Jesus, and let's say by the time I was 17, I knew that waging war was incompatible with the Sermon on the Mount. I just knew that. I mean, right, I got a Bible, I read it, and I saw that. And so as a teenager, and then maybe into my early 20s, I just knew that waging war was incompatible with following Jesus. I just knew that. And then I got taught. And I became more and more comfortable with violence, which I had not been from the moment I'd met Jesus. But then things got Americanized in my theology. It didn't happen all at once. It happened over a period of time. And, of course, the myth of redemptive violence is so seductive in America. You know, and it's summed up in the icon of the American mythical cowboy. mm-hmm. with his trusty six shooter who sets all wrongs to right by killing the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And I eventually was seduced into that. When 9/11 happened, that evening, I was part of organizing a prayer gathering at the local university, which thousands of people came. And that night, I don't have a record of what I prayed. I hope it doesn't exist, but I know what I prayed more or less, and it was a war prayer. I knew that the only way America could frame what had happened was in terms of war, and that our response would be war. And so I prayed a prayer blessing the American war effort that I was certain was inevitable. And then things began to change. And I had a mystical experience, to be honest with you, when I was sitting with Jesus in prayer. It's a contemplative practice that I have. And it was as if my affection for war was played back in my mind as an incriminating surveillance video. And Jesus said to me, "That's your worst sin."
Whoa, yep.
And it just crushed me, and I wept, and I repented deeply, and then embarked upon a thorough rethinking of all things pertaining to war. And out of that came, I got a stack of my books here, out of that came my the book of Farewell to Mars, which at the time, I think this is like a 2014 copyright. Yeah, 2014, so I probably wrote in 2013. At the time, before writing this, I said, I'm going to write a book that really makes the case that you can't wage war and follow Jesus at the same time. You got to choose. But I thought, oh, I'll wait till I'm older, till I had less to lose. And then my grandchildren were born. I have 7 and soon to be 8 grandchildren, but at the time I had 3. So it's dedicated for Jude, Mercy, and Finn. I want to read the I call it the prelude. Mm-hmm. I introduce the book by writing a little inscription to the book itself. It goes like this: "Dear little book, I had to write you. You wouldn't let me sleep until you were written. You were rude in your insistence. I had thought I would wait till I was older, till I had less to lose before I wrote you. But then Jude, Mercy, and Finn came along, and you insisted on being written for them. So I did your bidding. Now you are written. Soon you will be let loose to go where you will and speak to whom you may. Try not to cause me too much trouble. At least be kind enough to remind your readers that in writing you, I only told the truth. I wish you well. Your somewhat reluctant author, Brian Zahn." Now, that was 6 or 7 years ago the book came out. That book has actually caused me very little trouble. And I've had an awful lot of very in-depth conversations with career military men who appreciate the book. The only mindless criticism I get from people that never really had anything to do with military. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they think that their service is covered with, you know, saying to somebody, "Thank you for your service, and we'll let you get on the airplane first." Mm-hmm. I've had probably close to 10 letters and emails and even a few visits from career military people who read the book and resigned their commissions, left the military because of that. And I'm if it's okay to say, I'm more or less proud of that book. Yeah. I stand by that book.
Yeah. It's highly recommended, particularly for anyone who's struggling with that relationship between war and Jesus. I know that many, many followers of Christ are kind of having a reckoning when it comes to how do I frame that? How do I hold these two things? Highly recommend that book. Can you, Brian, then tell us about how do you reckon that with the Old Testament and the violence in the Old Testament?
There's a lot to be said about that. Look, let's be honest about it then. Let's not confine it to David and Goliath or, you know, Israelites versus Philistines. Let's just jump into it. Let's go to, like, for example, I think it's 1 Samuel 15, where the prophet Samuel instructs King Saul to go annihilate the Amalekites And this is the reason why, because centuries earlier, they had refused aid to Israel as they were arriving in Canaan. And the command is to kill, and there's four categories of people: men, women, children, and babies. Okay, I'm not making this up.
Mm-hmm.
This is there.
Mm-hmm.
Because of a crime or a lack of hospitality provided to Israel centuries earlier, now this particular people group is to be annihilated: men, women, children, and babies. Okay, killing men, that's what happens in war. We can discuss, you know, how that compatible that is with the way of Christ, but killing women and then children. And then we're given finally another category, babies. You know, folks, that's war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
You do that today and you'll end up in The Hague, mm-hmm. you know. And so I ask people this question: would you kill babies if God told you to? That's just, you know, woo. And so, first thing I say to that is there's only one correct answer.
Yes.
And the answer is no. And if you say yes, Kyle and I could go off on a whole discussion on Kierkegaard and transcending the ethical and, you know, yeah. fear and trembling. I have problems. I like Kierkegaard. I have whole problems with that. See, would you kill babies if God told you to? The only answer that is consistent with a well-formed conscience is no. You say, even first of all, I can't trust myself to discern God well enough to risk that I'm killing a baby and oops, got it wrong. Or I can't violate my own conscience. I would just finally have to stand my ground and say, God, if you want to kill babies, you're on your own there. I'm not doing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, this is the question you're really asking. You're asking me a Bible question because that story is there. Okay, you've got three options. And there's only three. And you may not like any of them. So pick your poison. One, you can question the morality of God. You can say, okay, or the morality of it, but say it that way, that ordinarily to kill babies is frowned upon, and we consider that, you know, beyond the pale. But if God commands it, then it's okay. Well, you know, that opens the door for future atrocities,
mm-hmm.
and it's happened. I can't do that. Others mm-hmm. maybe can. Maybe they say, well, if God says to do it, it's okay. I say, look, God, you gave me a conscience. I can't sin against my own conscience. Secondly, well, then you can question the immutability of God. You can say, well, once upon a time, you know, God ordered stuff like that, but over time he's changed. God has mutated. He's not immutable. He's mutating. He's moving beyond a history of violence into something other. Others, many can do that. I can't. I'm a classical theist in that sense. I hold to the immutability of God. If God is in the process of change, then the very ground beneath my feet is moving, and what do I stand upon? And so that leaves a third option, and that's that we question what we mean when we talk about the inspiration of Scripture. We have to question how we read Scripture. I view the Old Testament, first of all, it's canonical, okay? So it's part of our ongoing conversation that forms our theology. But I understand the Old Testament as the inspired telling of Israel's story of coming to know the living God. But along the way, assumptions are made. Make no mistake about it. The Old Testament does not speak in a univocal manner about many things. I mean, if you ask the Old Testament, hey, does God require ritual blood sacrifice? The priest and Moses and Deuteronomy and others say, yeah. And here's how you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can show you the verses in Leviticus where it says that sin offerings are required day by day. But then you keep moving on and you get to Psalms. And in Psalm 40, the psalmist says, you know, you've opened my ears. And sin offering and burnt offering you have not required. And then Hosea becomes bold enough to speak in the name of Yahweh and say, thus saith the Lord, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And so the Bible, the Old Testament especially, doesn't stand above the story it tells, but is fully immersed in it. The Bible itself is on the journey to discover the true word of God. So you start with it, you allow the story to be told, you journey with it, but you don't stop until you get to Jesus. The Bible's a little bit like a M. Night Shyamalan or whatever his name is, movie. that you have to get to the end of it before you can look back and properly understand the earlier portion. It's like watching Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you watch that movie and you get to the end and you go, how did I miss it? It was there all along. And so I have an Orthodox friend that he's a priest, theologian. He has no problem with simply saying, well, you know, Samuel, God used Samuel, but Samuel was also just kind of a bigoted old curmudgeon that didn't like Amalekites and operated in his own assumptions and wanted Israel to kill Amalekites. If in fact that's even what happened, you know, part of this is how the story is being told.
Mm-hmm.
So I simply have no problem with seeing the Bible as on the journey itself. And this issue that you've raised is a peculiarly, almost exclusively Protestant problem. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's the only authority we have. That when there was the great, I mean, I know there was the earlier schism, East and West, but when the great divorce came in the form of the Reformation, which we needed Reformation, the Renaissance mm-hmm. church was hopelessly corrupt. Instead of getting a full Reformation, we got a divorce. And, you know, divorces can be ugly and awful and the children suffer. And in the divorce settlement, Catholic mom got about everything. Protestant dad didn't get much, but he got the Bible. And so those of us that ended up with Protestant dad, God bless him, had to make the Bible everything.
Yes.
It had, because we don't have the church, we don't have the tradition, we don't have the really much of that sort of thing. We've got the Bible and we're going to hold on to it for dear life.
Mm-hmm.
And Protestants have done a lot of very good work in scriptural scholarship. But in the end, we have placed more of a burden on the Bible than it can bear.
Ooh.
And so we invent these wild ideas of infallibility and inerrancy and all of that and apply these modern categories that make no sense to the text. And that's when we get ourselves in situations where if I can't claim absolutely that God told Saul to kill babies, then the whole thing's a hoax. Mm-hmm. And we just don't have to go down that road.
Mm.
So I think ultimately it's how we understand scriptures and inspiration and authority.
Amen. Can we say cheers to that? Brian Zond, I'm drinking a really tasty Buffalo Trace, but that, what you're spitting, has me tingly, warm and tingly. So great. So let me get to the question that I've been really excited to ask you. Anyone who follows you on Twitter knows your deep and passionate love for Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And I've been wondering, I'd like to put in a request, Brian, but within the next maybe decade, you need to write a book on the theology of Bob Dylan. That's just, I think you owe it to the world, and particularly you owe it to hipster America. But
probably.
Yeah. And if anyone can do it, you can. So let me ask you,
it's my other canonical text. I have two canonical texts.
Nice.
You know,
good.
The Holy Scriptures and Bob Dylan.
Praise the Lord. So you're writing a book called The Theology According to Bob Dylan. What would some of the chapters be? What would Theology According to Bob Dylan feel like, sound like, taste like?
Well, let's see. One of my books already has a chapter entitled Shelter from the Storm, which is a, you know, a Bob Dylan song.
Mm-hmm.
Not dark yet. I might have to have that. There's an album called Oh Mercy.
Hmm.
Dylan lives in a world. Well, first of all, the thing about his lyrics are so vast, so sprawling. He's created a world with people and characters and geography and places. And it is a world where God is very present, where sin is real and the consequences of sin are real, but also grace is present. Bob Dylan had a real encounter with Jesus Christ in 1979, and that sort of reinvigorated his Judaism. If you asked Dylan today, if first of all, he wouldn't answer your question, but I mean, if you somehow could make him talk, you'd say, what's your religion? He'd say, I'm Jewish. But if you followed up, do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? He would say, yeah. And he's not going to be told that he can't do both at the same time because he does. And what I find is, what I find interesting, in fact, is that he's Jewish and that he might be a closer picture of what a Hebrew prophet was like than your, you know, standard evangelical preacher. In that the Hebrew prophets were poets, and Dylan is a poet. And the poetic and the prophetic are sometimes, it seems like, they're related. And Dylan seems to have this very unique gift to say something without too fine a point on it, to leave it open-ended so that it doesn't, you know, if you write a protest song that is very specific about one issue at one particular time in one particular nation, you know, it's got a pretty short lifespan. Dylan seems to be like, you know, whoever, who you want to pick, Jeremiah or Isaiah or whoever, whose poems are speaking to something that was real and current at the time, but are evasive enough and give enough space that they're still speaking to us. Then, you know, I can pick up Jeremiah and just flip open to it and find, you know, on any given page, I can probably find something that I'll say, that's speaking to me right now. And Dylan seems similar to that. So, and so in one sense, you know, the rock and roll artist that's going to be given the Nobel Prize for his lyrics, in one sense, he had to be Jewish. It just seemed like it had to be in that tradition.
I think that's right. My personal favorite lyricist is Leonard Cohen, also Jewish.
Exactly.
And Dylan loved him too for that reason.
I'm reminded, or I'm wondering, are there any similarities, would you say, Brian, between Dylan and Heschel even?
Sure. I mean, one of the most influential books I think I've ever read is Heschel's The Prophets.
Masterpiece. Yep.
Yeah. Again, that would be a book that had to be written by a Jew. You know, who's gonna write on the prophets but Heschel?
Yeah.
And I had a dream one time where I met Father Abraham. It's a long, I won't try to tell the whole story.
Not Heschel,
I met
but
Father Abraham.
In the dream,
he was Abraham the patriarch, but he had the exact appearance of Abraham Joshua Heschel. And it was an interesting dream.
Are you working on anything that
I'm going to finish up probably in January my 10th book in 12 years. So I have been writing. But I've submitted to IVP as of a few weeks ago, a completed manuscript entitled What Can We Do When Everything's on Fire? They'll probably try to change the title, and they will probably not succeed. I mean, technically, the publisher, you know, has the right to give it the title, but I can be pretty stubborn when I set my mind to it. And Kyle, this book more or less opens with a retelling of Nietzsche's parable of the madman.
I teach that every semester.
Where is God? And we can't find God. Remember, he's I don't have to tell you, but you know, he's got the lantern, and it's, you know, bright sunny day. Like, we cannot find God. We're looking for God, and the villagers think this is ludicrous, and they're making fun of him and mocking him. And finally, he smashes the lantern and says, "Oh, I see. I've come too soon." And but now I'm kind of riffing on the idea that the madman's lantern was sort of like Mrs. O'Leary's lantern that the cow kicks over. And now we're living in a time when all kinds of faith is imperiled by these flames. And so this is a book where ultimately, I probably do say this, but I'm speaking to people that are going through deconstruction. And I want to try to be a trusted guide. I want to walk them through this so you don't have to lose everything. There's a way to make it through. And so I have a chapter entitled Deconstructing Deconstruction. And we look at Derrida a little bit and some other things. So I'm pretty excited about this book. The full-on, you know, serious philosophers, I don't know. They make me nervous. They'll probably tell me 17 things that are wrong with what I'm doing. But that's not really what the book is about. The book is really about trying to help Christians hold on to their faith. So that will come out sometime next year. Don't have a publication date. And this is my writing desk. I'm seated at my writing desk. Right now I'm working on an Advent devotion, the anticipated Christ. And, you know, that'll come out. The problem is I'm writing enough that you get into conflicts. You can't release two books too close to each other. So
must be a nice problem to have.
So anyway, yeah, I've got plenty going on.
Where can our listeners find your books, your stuff?
Well, Zahnd, Z-A-H-N-D, is a great filter. there's a fair amount of Zahnds in Switzerland, but there's not many of us here. So if you just put Zahnd in front of all kinds, if you just Google Zahnd, you'll find me probably. But I have a website that I now and then do a blog post, but blogging is so 2010-ish. You know, we hardly do it anymore. I mean, I do now and then. I have in the last week or so, but brianzahnd.com. Mm-hmm. I'm active on Twitter where I'm something of a provocateur. I think I'm actually a kinder, gentler soul than I appear on Twitter. I hope I'm trying. And Instagram, Facebook, Amazon, you can find my books.
Yep.
That sort of thing.
Awesome. Brian Zahnd, thank you so much again for your time. Thanks for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
Well, cheers. I don't trust myself to talk for over an hour and a half with a
glass of whiskey,
with a beverage in my hand, you know. But I'm gonna go get one.
Awesome.
Yeah. Enjoy the Ardbeg or whatever you end up with.
Thanks for spending this time with us. We really hope that you're enjoying these conversations as much as we are. And if you are, help us get the word out. Before you close your podcast app, leave a rating or a review. That helps new listeners find us, maybe for the first time. If you'd like to share the episode you just heard with a friend or a family member, you can find those links on our social media pages. You can also find us over on Patreon at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. And that's going to work well for you, whether you're a kind enough person to financially support us out of the goodness of your heart, or if you're just looking for merch or the chance for a private tasting. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.